Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Jenny Rometty is with me today. Last year, she retired from IBM after a 40-year career there. She was the company's ninth CEO and ended her tenure as the executive chairman. Under Jenny's leadership, the company was transformed into a software and services giant from its hardware origins. Optimizing that portfolio involved reinventing more than 50% of the company's portfolio and acquiring some 65 companies during her time as CEO, including Red Hat, the largest acquisition in the company's history. She is well known for being a leading voice on technology ethics and data stewardship, and for mentoring the next generation of leaders, particularly with her work to help enable people from diverse backgrounds and education levels just to participate in the 21st century digital economy. And to that end today, she is the co-chairman of 110, which we'll be talking about shortly. In addition, Jenny is vice chair of the board of trustees of Northwestern University, her alma mater. She's on the board of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and she is on the board of JP Morgan Chase. And in addition to all of that, she is a senior advisor to Teneo. I am delighted to have her on the call for the first time. So Jenny, welcome. Before we get into the leadership of tomorrow, I thought we might as well start with the leadership of today, because as you know, the last year has presented some pretty profound challenges for leaders and of organizations of all kinds, with a pandemic, with the impact on the economy and the preparation to recover from the economy, the social justice movement, the election and its aftermath, human rights issues. The list goes on and on. There have been a lot of plates spinning for a lot of leaders this past year. In your view, how have they done? How has corporate America performed during this incredible period?
Well, Kevin, first, thank you. And it is great to join my first Teneo webcast. So my pleasure. And appreciate everyone joining us together, you and I together. I guess I'd answer that a couple ways. One, I have seen the Edelman reports on trust, and they would all tell you corporate America did really well, and that people have the most trust in anyone. They have it in their companies now. So if you look at it from an external view, I think that's one window. I think my own personal view is I think that corporate America did a great job, and probably because it had a very clear view of priorities, which was the first was keep everybody safe. Then the second thing was, do what contribute what you can. Just look at what all the pharmas did, obviously, on the vaccine, et cetera. And then help everyone get back to work and at the same time try to reinvent yourself. So, I was, the other day someone was asking me about, all of us think back a year ago or a little bit more than a year ago. And I was on a CNBC, I don't know what made me, it popped up in my like Apple phone as a little video or something about this. And it showed me my video of what I said back in March of 2020. And people said, well, what did you think? And I would just sort of end answering your question with, it's interesting what I said then was clinically true. Because I said, look, I would think there'd be three big changes as a result, corporate America, hybrid work, supply chain resilience. And I said, things would be as contact-free as they could be because obviously those who could operate that way did. Okay, that's what I said a year ago. All true still, by the way, I believe. But I have a more interesting kind of nuanced view after, and I look back and I say, what did the pandemic do? And to me, it showed us that trust was underrated. So I think now that it really put that in the center. I think, sort of the top marks go to those who were most authentic during this time, and you could really define yourself. And I think it put a really big flashlight on things that we're going to talk about, which is that how fragile the quality was. And on the other hand, gives us a big opportunity to fix it. And I think economic opportunity is one of the ways to fix it. But it was, yes, clinically, things you could see would change. Corporate America saw that. And I think now a really good side benefit is that point about people focusing on trust, people focusing on equality. And I would add one other point, which is I think everybody started to realize how they did things was almost more important than what they did. And so I'll end there.
You know, you've talked to me in the past about the importance of leaders being in the right place at the right time for a particular company, and not every leader would have been as effective in that moment in a company's history. And as we think about the next generation of leadership that's coming up, one of the things that has always struck me about you as I've looked at your career is that you're kind of a rarity, not unlike another friend of our firm who has been on this program a number of times, Ursula Burns, in that both of you spent your entire careers built at those companies that you wound up being the CEOs of. And I think that there's always a tension there, right? On the one hand, at a moment of intense crisis or change in the global economy or in your operating environment, you know where everything, you know every nook and cranny of that company, and you know where the bodies are, so to speak. On the other hand, somebody who parachutes in as a new CEO of a company oftentimes brings a breath of fresh air and a fresh perspective to a company. Talk about that. I mean, it's an increasingly rare CEO who's spent their entire career at a company. But what are the pros and cons that you see on that front?
Look, I think there's two sides to it. And one is from the individual person, the other is for the company. And you know that old saying, horses for courses. And I think it is very true that when you hire a CEO, you're hiring them for the next challenge, right? Not what the company looks like today. Now, back up those. Before all of us become that, you know, why did you stay? When people will say to me, like, why did you stay all that time, 40 years? And I would say, like, I felt like I had many different careers in that time frame. And any company, I think, kind of, all they can do is you have to earn the right that I want to stay for one more job. And I would say that to even people who would say they want to leave, I'd say, look, all I need you to do is I earn the right to keep you with every new job you take. I mean, you're going to make a decision every time. And so on one hand, for me, you ask, why would I, you know, that's a rarity. I think people stay if they keep getting new challenges. I think that's very obvious for anybody listening. Okay, now flash forward, you said, and can you breath of fresh air, new eyes? I don't think it's about whether the person's new or old or been there or not, because there's clearly benefit to knowing how to get things done, particularly when the organization is of scale and complexity. So clearly benefit. But Kevin, I think another way to look at it is that it's more about your mindset. And I will say one of the things I learned in my time at IBM was know what must endure, have the wisdom to know what must endure, and then be willing to change everything else. And I don't think you need to be new or old to the company to have that belief. And I think particularly in these times, that's more the ethos that's needed for everybody, whether you've been with the company or not been, because the pace of change is so fast. So it isn't just about changing people now. So it is more about your belief on that topic. And that is a hard topic to come to terms with. But I think if you do, and because people always talk about, even with me and you talked about changing 50% of the portfolio, it's easy to change a lot of things. It's way harder to understand what must endure and really, you know, kind of shine that and build off of that.
So there are many, many changes afoot in the economy writ large that were already well underway. I know you've talked about this a lot. And all of those trends were compounded or exacerbated, accelerated even by the pandemic and the experiences of the, of the last year. And I'm wondering, though, you know, in this moment where also everybody from the Teneos of the world and other companies that are looking for highly qualified individuals, you know, down to every single Starbucks that you'll walk by here in New York City, there is a help wanted sign out there. But so much of this comes down to the preparation of our workforce and our future workforce for the needs of the 21st century economy. And this has been something that you've taken a leadership position on. You've talked a lot about new collar jobs, if you will, the reclassification of job descriptions and the like. But talk about this right now and how some of the initiatives you've been working on fit into all of that.
Okay, so this is, to your point, this is something I'm really passionate about. But it is worth a little bit of, I got to give you a little bit of history of what brought me to it. Sure. First, there's a personal part, right? I was raised by a single mom. My dad left when my mom was I was 16. My mom was very young. The short of that is my mom had never gone to school and found herself with four kids and on food stamps. Now, my mother, I saw the value of an education. So I just want to park that thought. My mother had to go back to school to feed us, to get us off of aid. And I watched the difference of when my mother went back after to get an associate degree and what it did. So this has left a mark on me from a very early age. So put that aside. Boom. Now, then go back 10 years. So here, we kind of forget all this. This is 10 years ago, post the financial crisis. I'm trying to do hiring at IBM in technology, particularly cybersecurity. And unemployment is almost 10% in the world. In our country, I can't find people with the skill. Okay, you're like, okay, they are not to be found. So at that time, it started with a need that I needed people that could do this kind of work. And was there a new pool to go after? Park that. So we did. We said, look, what if we went after associate degrees and went to certain schools, helped them with curriculum with this work? Now that'll come back. That will end up to be something very influential, I think, for the world to learn from, because it worked. Park that thought. Then the second thing was, okay, now the digital transformation takes off. And I have a real fear, and do to this day, about the digital divide, that you have the have and have nots. And in the U.S., you could see it. All the wealth, West Coast, East Coast. Middle is, I always say, it's like as if time left it behind in the middle of the country. You saw this with the politics, everything that happened. So it was a hollowing out of the middle.
Remote schools in particular. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And you've seen like work MIT has done on the hollowing out of the middle, where low-paid jobs are on the rise, or college degree. But boy, there's nothing there like raise a good family in the middle. Then enter George Floyd and systemic racism that then puts a real spotlight. So I have like these five dot points across my life that have pulled together this point to me that, okay, now I can give it a name and crystallize it for everybody, that was called Skills First. Meaning, even though I work so hard to go to a great university, and everybody's wish for their child is that, in many, but that can you begin in just a different spot, and maybe without your degree first, if you have aptitude and you have some set of skills. And so it was this paradigm we kind of coined called Skills First. The idea that could I hire you based on your skills, not just your quote credentials. And I won't even enter into the part about the U.S. has $180 billion of debt every year on this, and can every college graduate even get a degree? I mean, there's a lot of wasted money anyways. And so that's what is what led me down this path of where I think to take our conversation. But I want to pause. Yes, influenced from my youth, but driven by a real business need. I needed employees that had a skill. And then third was, I also could see this social issue that was going to be no good. Because by the way, people thought technology was the root of this problem. And now they're going to hate this technology because they think they got a bad future because of AI and other things. So to me, this was like a perfect storm of things that gave me great resolve about trying to get the whole country on a movement to hire for skills first. And then we can talk more about it from there. But it's been proven now at scale in what we're doing.
Well, so can you now draw that connection to PTEC and that program? Because, you know, I guess the question I have for you is, again, it comes down to leadership. How do you get the entire organization to see things that way and to think along those lines? Because what's interesting, I think, for a lot of our audience is that IBM, of all places, is going to be seen as a place that would, in theory, require the most qualified and credentialed types of employees. And yet you made this leap. How does that happen?
Okay, I think for everyone, he has a really good point, because in the move of doing this, when I could see that, geez, I can capture people at a different stage of life and bring them on, we had been 100% PhDs and four-year degrees at a minimum, 100%. And initial reaction, and I'm now, as I work with so many companies, seeing this everywhere, the initial reaction is, well, you're dumbing down the workforce. You're bringing in people. This is going to change who we are. And so how do you convince them? Because honestly, yes, it will change who you are. It'll make you more diverse and it will make you better. But I have to convince you, and depending on your workforce, analytical they are, right? And so just our story of how we got there, it doesn't need to be yours, right? And I'll come back to that. We at the time started these schools called PTEC, Pathway to Technology, Early College High School. Oh, what a name, right? What a long name. That's why I shortened to PTEC. But the idea was go to high schools in the worst parts of the world with a community college. They're called different things in different countries. And could you help them with, give them an idea of a curriculum for what's in demand, because you know how many schools do not teach what's in demand. Give them a mentor electronically of your employees, and give them a chance at an internship. And I will tell you, of those three things, curriculum, mentor, intern is what changes everything for these people. It's all first generation. And so we started that. Now this goes back 10 years. Fast forward today, there's 300 schools in, soon to be 300, in 27 countries, pipeline of 200,000 kids coming through. But here's sort of more the punchline. We studied things like their innovation, their quality of their work, because I have a workforce to convince that this is a good thing. I knew it was. It would make it not more diverse because 90% were Black and Hispanic. Next thing. As it turned out, we measured their innovation. For the first year, it's slightly below our four-year degree employees. After, equal or above. Okay, check. That is no longer what the issue is. Then next, guess what? Something I didn't expect. 74% went on and got college degrees. They just did it in a different way, and we have had our first PhD. So this convinced me of what I knew from what I watched with my mother. This was not an issue of aptitude. This was an issue of who had access to what.
Right.
And I, this is why I'm like, I'm so such a strong supporter of this. And that next kind of convincing point, if you now hire for skills instead of just a degree, others have done the study that you say is 5x more predictive that they'll be successful than just looking at their degree, more retentive and more loyal. So I'm sort of like, okay, this is a very good thing for business and very, you know, when do you get a win-win-win? Good for society, good for business, good for diversity and inclusion and creativity. So if you're listening, I hope I've convinced you, you know, to give this. Now, there's a lot of systemic barriers. Your job requisitions are a systemic barrier. We could go through what does it take to change your job requisitions. And even if you change them, I guarantee you'll still hire college grads unless you then change your management, train your management. You got to match supply and demand. You got to look at new pathways. There's a number of things. But you, circling what you started the question on, it's also bias. And so in my case, it was a workforce who's very analytical. So we gave them data. And of course, I also said, oh, you don't get to just have one or two in your department. You're each going to get 100 because it's a cohort. Then they're not an experiment. They're a real living part of your company. And so I would showcase these, we call them new collar. That's where you mentioned this word for those listening. Again, everybody, I picked the name just because I was trying to get away from people thinking that if you don't have a college degree, you're blue collar versus white collar, to say, no, this is just like a new category of student or employee that just happens to have come to us with the skills. We captured them on a different pathway, maybe earlier, maybe later through an apprenticeship. And here they are, and that's why we call it new collar. So, sorry, you can tell I'm passionate. End of that story is 43% of IBM's job recs no longer require college to start, and 15% of the hiring in the U.S. last year were these new collar people. And, I mean, I know it. We'll talk a little bit about 110. I know it from the work there that we're now working with 50 of the largest companies in the country. Everybody's all over the board on this topic. People say the words, they have not yet done the work of what it is to do this yet, right? So we're, in my view, we get this done across the country. This will be like the best thing for corporate America and for diversity and inclusion together.
You talked about some of the barriers. And I know that one of the barriers is geographic location of workers. Economists are always going to be, you know, assume that there's this fungibility, right? Like people can move to where leave where jobs are in decline and move to where jobs are growing. And we know with an increasing body of academic work on that, this is simply not true. So it seems to me that one of the things that has that you just focused on there was the role also of community colleges or two-year colleges, let's call them, right?
Yeah.
That can play. And it's interesting that that the new First Lady is a community college professor herself and is a big champion and advocate for this. But that you know, they can play a very instrumental role in the retraining or the preparation for people within a community who perhaps their predecessors have all worked in a single industry, that either that is needs to morph into a 21st century competitive industry, or there are new industries that are going to move in. But there needs to be a good relationship with those who are going to be doing the hiring and employing. Those employers need to give the message, this is the kind of worker I need you to prepare for me. Is corporate America doing a good job of interfacing with those schools?
Yeah, so this is a really good and interesting point for everybody on the phone, because I'm not saying you have to build a PTEC program, because PTECs only turn 1,000 kids. That's not going to solve this problem. In fact, all of us have our own program is the problem, and they don't necessarily scale. It is, though, about each one of us locally working in an ecosystem, in whatever the programs happen to be, to do what you said. So in PTEC, we have 600 other companies working locally like that. Now, I will just say something. I happened to last night. I grabbed it off my desk. I was reading, and again, I'm not an academic here, but I was reading, I know Adam Posen well, and I'm on the board of the Peterson Institute. It's called The Price of Nostalgia, if anyone. It does challenge what you just said, Kevin. It says that this belief that people will not move for their jobs in certain labor, you know, sort of brackets, and that it says we should kind of dismiss that notion, and that's part of how certain parts of this country were built, that huge populations migrated to do things, and that we should assist people to do that. But generally what you say is very true. And that is why all this work is really pretty local, that you're going to public-private partnership, I guess is a short answer to that, that any company today on the phone to me has got to take that up. Again, it's how they're going to get their next workforce. So this is not ESG work. This is, to me, like smack dab in the area of if you have a productive, you know, workforce and a country. And so when 60% of Americans do not have a college degree, there is not time to catch this up, and it'll jump us to the topic of, if I might, on racial equality. This is how this group we're in called 110 was born, because of like-minded, when the killing of George Floyd and a number of the different things that ensued around that, you know, people are making lots of commitments, saying lots of things, and I'm a big believer in diversity and inclusion. It comes to authenticity, accountability, and just action. And the best thing business can do is what it does, is hire. And so for Black Americans, the best thing we could do is provide economic opportunity. I believe it's the great equalizer of all things. And so, in particular, when I say Americans in general, 60% don't have a college degree, hey, 80% of Blacks don't have a college degree. So McKinsey did a study. If you want to get parity in a work, it'll take us 100 years unless we do something.
Right.
So
right.
This is like so obvious to me as a good thing to do for a particular population as well. But one other thing about this mobility point in community colleges, sorry, I circled off a second there, but really interesting statistic, I think, for everybody listening. I was talking to MIT, who was doing a study on future work. And at first I was like, you know, this idea that 60% of Americans don't have a college degree, after we put $180 billion of you know, federal aid a year into this quest, I said, what do the other developed countries look like? You know, is it the same, you know, are they like much more? He said, oh, no, it's actually pretty close to the same in the other developed countries. That one big difference. Things like apprenticeships or going into non-4-year degree programs, they are 19 times larger in Germany and 11 times larger in Canada than what the United States was. Isn't that interesting? And so they said, so what they did was they don't focus on just college to an exclusion. It's like they focus on other pathways into the workforce to be productive, like you just said, and they really cultivate those, which is what's led me, you know, as well down that path. And again, not to shun a 4-year degree. I'm all for them. Keep going, right, as far as you'll go, but it's where you start.
It's also, it's a mind frame, right, that a term like vocational is not a pejorative.
It has a bad connotation. It does. That's right.
Yeah. So you've mentioned 110 a number of times. So perhaps, I think there are probably many people on the call who are not intimately familiar with it. So maybe tell us a little bit more about it, what it is, what it is doing.
So I'm probably going to sound like
you're talking about.
Yeah, I hope I don't sound like a commercial, Kevin. I mean, this is a not-for-profit. This started, you will know many of the people I'll mention. And this was, when I say like-minded, Ken Chenault of Amex, Ken Frazier of Merck, Charles Phillips, Oracle, Kevin Shearer, who had run Amgen, myself, kind of the founding fathers of this idea that said, hey, the best thing we could do for all of this around racial justice is give people a really great upward mobile job. And start with the Black population, non-four-year degree. So this is where these all my thoughts intersect. And when I sort of fell in love at first sight on joining this, because I thought, ah, we can finally scale this thought. And the idea is 1 million over 10 years. I think we're going to beat it by far. But that's where the name 110 came from. 1 million over 10 years, family-sustaining jobs. So not bad jobs. These are... depending on the part of the country, 50, 60, 70,000 a year starting and upwardly mobile. And we went around to all of our colleagues and said, look, we help work on the systemic barriers. And it means you got to change your company like I did to Skills First. Then you got to be willing to work local, like you said, form an ecosystem and work locally with your colleagues in the community colleges and other talent providers, because none of them are at scale. I was on the Reimagine New York reopening. And big jobs is a big piece of it. And you know, you go through all of the little groups and non-for-profits in New York that create credentials or skilling for people, and they do 30, 40 people a year. I mean, you're never going to get there at these numbers. So we said to all our colleagues, Ken and I and everybody went around. So to date, we have over now 50 big employers. We're going to be moving to small, medium too, but we felt the big guys could really kind of do the heavy lifting to start, and they have to make a commitment to hire either 250 to 500 a year, a little ramp up time, of non-four-year degree Black employees, change their job recs, work in ecosystem, and then work on retention and promotion. And they've all, you know, as CEOs, we always take our commitments on, you know, seriously. They've made the commitments, and we've already, for the first 29 companies, gotten through the job recs that could therefore be changed, and we're at already 20,000 jobs at 71,000 starting salary. We have 23 cities that will soon be popping up the second half now, where a CEO and a group of CEOs are going to all form the ecosystem and pop them up. So Mary Barra is doing the Detroit area, Ed Bastian's doing Atlanta, Target, Cargill, I think Medtronic are all doing Minneapolis, Bob Bradway's Amgen out on the West Coast. Or others are joining a group, or Alex Gorsky on J&J is going to run the military-connected group in some way. And we are ready to hire. And, I mean, but what we really got into on this, and we'll soon have 25 talent suppliers. So they range from, like, Udacity to Merit America, and then Community College, Dallas Community College. You know, we're just getting this all. Actually, we're pretty fast. And we've got... at least 100 million for the first year of seed money. If we need it, it'll be a billion over 10 years. But so money's not our issue. It's people committing jobs, and we've got it. So now you have what you said a minute ago. We have demand, and when you have demand, you can shape up supply, right? I mean, like our normal business, right? Because we go to these guys and say, hey, I got 1,000 cyber jobs in Atlanta. Will you four and you three do this? If you do it, I'll hire these people. I mean, I have the jobs ready to go. And like I said, hiring starts this month already. We have a tech platform to do it. So I am so excited about the progress. And if anyone on the phone wants to join, I hope I'm not losing people on my... Whatever you do, do what's actionable is my point. And if we can help you lift the boat, because what we found is people say, oh, I'm doing some of this, but they're all quickly learning. Their HR groups can only work with 4 or 5 of these suppliers, not 100. I mean, we will lift the boats. And by the way, then people say, why only Blacks? And we're like, look, we're going to start like a startup focused. But as we remove all these barriers, we're removing them for everybody. So honestly, the net opens and you catch, we're going to really help all the diverse groups as a result.
So a lot of what you're talking about here obviously goes to taking down barriers and to, you know, lessening some of the many inequities that have prevailed in this country for a very long time. But there's another element, there's another collateral effect of what you're talking about, right, which is the competitiveness of this country as we, you know, as we enter the next phase of the global economy. And I'm not just talking about corporate competitiveness. I'm talking about at a national level, strategic competition, specifically in a world with an assertive China, right? So as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, you will have received, as I just did, you know, their latest task force report, which is about China's Belt and Road Initiative. And they make clear in there, as have many others, right, that the Belt and Road Initiative is about much more than building infrastructure in the developing world, right? This is about defining the rules of the economic operating environment of the future. It is about setting the technical standards, securing markets and supply chains. You know, as you look at, are we falling behind in this battle vis-a-vis China?
Yeah. So look, I mean, I was a strong supporter of TPP as an example, and made many a call in many a country and in our own country on, from the president down, and you know, we were almost at that goal line on TPP because, part of that answer on China is that, you really want to be fully engaged. You want to have strategic competition with China, and you want to do it in with your friends and family around, you know, not alone as a country. And so when you say, to me, it was clear, the Belt and Road Initiative for China has always been around influence in many parts of the world, contribute for influence, right, as they built that out. And so not that that's bad. It reminds me, Kevin, of a story I can remember presenting at the China Development Forum or around the forum a number of years ago, one of the major forums where as you well know what it is. And I remember in my talk, I said, look, if I was a country of over a billion people, I too would build a technology industry. You know, and to this day, China's number one import is semiconductors. Now, you know, so to be critical that they're trying to build all these industries, you would build them too, all right, now. So to me, the most important thing then is to keep them in a global system, right? Which is why I was such a strong proponent of globalization on this, that the safest thing for the country, all countries, is to keep everybody interdependent, right? I mean, that was said decades ago by many people, right? You know, world peace through world trade is something IBM's founder had said, world peace through world trade, right? When you're interdependent, you don't fight with each other too much. And so I felt that, so we say, now, are we falling behind? All right, so here's where I worry the most. We can come back to some specifics on technology. But as an example, this morning there was a little blurb on a news thing about kind of on AI. It had a big breakthrough on the number of parameters it could look at in doing natural language processing and the size. So are they winning in AI or are they not? I mean, America is still ahead on these points. But there are two things we could lose on, and it's not the technology. You can lose on one, the skills race, and two, our focus. Are we diffused? So you said about the amount of money that goes into research, development, all that needs to be beefed up. And America has every capability to do it if it determines it's important to do it, right? So we are creating far less engineers than are required, or STEM trained. Let's just put it that way. I'm STEM trained, right? So I always tell kids and everyone I know, please go into engineering. You don't have to be an engineer, but it does teach you a way of working and thinking, right? And right. I would completely beef up what we do, whether it's community college, everything in that area. And the second is our focus on what are the key technologies that matter and that we really excel in them versus a little bit of everything. And that's what it's going to take to, I think, maintain what is our lead. So I don't believe it's like, it's not a game of numbers and size. It is that idea of focus and skills. Isn't that interesting? It isn't really about people, oh, if they're going to win in AI because they have more data. And as I was talking to someone this morning, I agree with him. It's like, this is not a more data game. This is about the other point, the skill, and about this idea of this country can focus on those things. That the kinds of, when you say AI is very broad, you got to decide, like, which kinds of AI make the difference to America's future, right? And really, whether it's quantum computing as well, those kind of things.
But a number that does sort of stand out, and Bloomberg had another story on this just this morning, you know, U.S. government R&D spending, U.S. government R&D spending as a percentage of GDP peaked at 2.2% back in 1964, right? So height of the Cold War, after the Sputnik moment. Last year, it was 0.7%. And that's in a depressed GDP environment, for that matter, right? So I guess, given everything you were just saying,
that's a problem. That is a problem.
Should we be looking at this as a Sputnik moment right now?
Yeah. Well, I've heard others call it that too, right? And that the country needs an investment agenda in R&D in that kind of a moment. And I think it is very, very true. And we're a company, we're the oldest tech, so of enough of a memory of how some of the major technologies that still run the world today, they were as a result of collaboration in government. But it was also a different time in government where they knew their role was to help, they would fund industry to help build things, knowing that industry would commercialize. So in addition to the funding, the other thing I'd bring back is that mentality versus a little bit too much today is I'll help you fund it and then I want to keep it. That isn't going to ever get us to the world you're at. I think America's greatest strength was R&D. Yes, it was done at a government, but it also funded private sector to do some of that R&D. And then private sector went off and commercialized it even more. And that's what gave us the momentum. That's, to me, the model that I would pull those elements forward with the amount of money.
Do you think that, once you start to disaggregate from those headline numbers, the numbers become even more disturbing when you look at actual just basic research, and that there's not enough basic research being done. Would you agree or not?
I would say I don't exactly agree on that. I would say that it's more important that the basic research be done in the right areas. So, it's always like my own at IBM, when people are budgeting things, okay, there's always enough money if you focus on the right things, okay? So if you are not, wasting a lot in other places that really make the difference. And so I feel that way here too. So I think the country's quite able to put the kind of money we're talking into to do this. I mean, here's another like a little bitty example of this, in that if you take a look at something, it's come to forefront because of the pandemic, broadband. A number of us have been talking about there should be broadband, almost like electricity, right, as a basic right in the country. And it really showed how kids couldn't go to school and all this. There wasn't broadband everywhere. And you might know, the estimates I've read, it's maybe $100 billion to get broadband right in cities and rural areas. That's a drop in the bucket. I mean, look at the size of these the aid packages, $1.9 trillion, $4 trillion. I mean, $100 billion, really? So this is where I go back to, this is a matter of deciding what is most important to the country's future. And I do think things like AI, quantum computing, in particular, those two technologies would be places, and 5G, by the way, where I would put that.
So those concentrations that you're talking about, that also suggests, again, this kind of coming together, public-private partnership. We obviously saw that to some degree and in a great way with Operation Warp Speed. It's amazing how a year ago, we were at the bottom of the performance bucket in terms of pandemic response, and now we're near the top thanks to that. On another level, SpaceX, the commercialization of space, NASA working with private sector companies has achieved some phenomenal things. So, what's the right balance here? And again, this is also going to require a lot of leadership, both at a political level and at a corporate level to make that work. And is the environment emollient enough to allow that to happen, right?
Oh, okay. Well, you're the political strategist, not me. Okay, I'm this environment emollient stuff. I knew you would get there eventually. I want it to be, and I'm going to keep working to help make it be that way, that they're come together on these points we agree on so that it isn't about a divide. This is not really an issue of Republicans or Democrats or anything else, right? I come back to that word. It is making a decision about priorities, though, to get that to happen. And to your point about basic research, for sure more needs to go into as well basic research that underpins all of this. And so I'm still somewhat, Kevin, optimistic that can take a few more steps forward. But I do think time is of the essence. So we don't quite have that luxury of the past of how slowly those things move. They are moving faster now. So now is the time for the country to have a real national technology agenda, right? And that's what people would say China has always had, right? It's had a national agenda for these things. And it's been a long time since we had a national technology agenda.
Yeah, it's. I think it's always interesting that, you know, the competition now is effectively an extension of the economic and foreign policy of the country, even if it's an erstwhile, you know, private sector company in China. But when you think about all of the things we've been talking about on not just on this competitiveness front and technology and research front, on the workforce front and whatnot, you know, you brought up ESG a little earlier in your comments, but this notion of stakeholder capitalism and then, you know, the elements of ESG and institutional investors and other stakeholders being drivers, how effective are you seeing that being now, and how does that play into what you've been talking about?
Well, a couple things. I was one of the helpers and workers on the Business Roundtable, Purpose of a Corporation. And, you know, there's been lots of articles written, although most people listening to you, many are listening to us, are in a company, right? To me, I felt that it was just enshrining what anyone who had a company that had a long corporate life already knew, that if you didn't serve all those stakeholders in the right way, in the right sort of ebb and flow, society will take away your license to operate. I've been using that phrase for a couple of years, license to operate. And so it's a little bit secondhand to me that I'm like, of course I have multiple stakeholders, right? So now that's not true to everybody though. Not everyone views them that way. And I remember people saying, well, does that mean this one is now, you know, the shareholder's dead, it's not number one. And I'm sick of it. I keep saying people, I think all my colleagues, we don't get to live in a black and white world. It's not like that. I don't get to say, this is one, this is two. I mean, at all times, it's about living in a gray area, you know, and how you balance those things. And so now, has it put a productive focus on things? I think it can. Like anything, you know, you'll hear people say things are greenwashed now, or, you know, and that's why I get back to all of these things. To me, you got to really do some soul searching on the authenticity of, like, why do you do it? And then what's really, does it mean to be accountable? And then what are your real actions? Forget about the report, the headlines, the numbers. And then those are all a byproduct of that, right? And I was on the phone with someone the other day, you know, we were talking about they were saying to me they had just done all these diversity sessions. They had done a lot of listening sessions, this and that. And I don't know what I asked. I said, well, okay, so what do your real numbers look like? Oh, well, that's a different, you know, we're not necessarily want to share all that and talk about that. And I'm like, well, this is a very odd conversation to me. And even amongst yourselves, I mean, I'm talking about to go to a newspaper or something, but so that willingness to be accountable then, but I go back to, I said, you guys got to go back to, like, why are you doing all this diversity work, right? Like, I really believe I get better products. I get better innovation from the team. I mean, you really have to have you got to believe that versus, hey, I'm complying with something. And so, you know, in my life, I had many of those experiences that I came to believe it really strong. I mean, just I'm talking about the P-Tech kids, right, that are far more innovative. I mean, I really believe this is a good thing. So why wouldn't I do it? And environment. We did an environment report. I think this might be almost close to our 30th year of an environment report. Like, nobody was asking for environment. I actually had shareholders say, hey, you guys should really publish that thing to us because, you know, you're doing all this work. I mean, we were doing it because we thought it was the right thing to do. And so, and we needed it for our own business. So all that's a lot of air to say, you know, what do I think of it? I think it's great. I hope it raises all boats. But I start with getting really clear in your head on why you're doing some of these things so that, you know, those of us on the phone that lead companies, I tell you, everybody smells out authenticity really fast now, right? And are you complying or is it because you believe?
Right. So I think it should be pretty clear to everybody who's on this call that you feel pretty strongly about a lot of the issues you've been talking about today. I want to pivot to something else that you feel strongly about, and that is technology ethics and data protection and stewardship. You know, with the economy, with the global economy undergoing very profound change, the nature of work, as you've been speaking about, relations, technology is changing the relation between government and its citizenry. We're dealing with multiple truths out there, a declining belief in science in some sectors, privacy debates versus privacy expectations of an American versus, say, a Chinese, between countries and systems, between generations, have different views on all of this. And clearly, as we've seen when, your peers, technology CEOs have testified in Congress, that oftentimes our elected officials don't really understand either the business models or the technologies that underpin them. So what's the right approach here in this world where we haven't defined properly the taxonomy in many cases? We haven't defined where the red lines of behavior are. Who should take the, how do we tackle this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And again, from being a firm, I think you approach it two directions, both from a government perspective, but also then from a company perspective. But when you said I feel strongly, look, there's a lot of things I feel strongly. I don't always get my timing right on all of them, I must say. Because I can remember talking about this topic of technology regulation in Davos maybe, I can't remember, it's 5, 6, 7 years ago. I'm like, God, no one's very interested in this topic, But I was like a little ahead of the time, I guess. And part of why I was talking about it then was I always feel companies are better to self-regulate themselves, self-regulate or set the standards versus have it done to them, right? And so when you say, what should we do? So on one hand, what I do believe, first for a company, let me answer that. Like each of us have to decide our own set of values and want to live by them and really test yourself. Like I believed, and we did a lot of work on this, that the purpose of technology should be to help man and make him better. That means you won't do certain things. Right? Or it means if you do them, as an example, we build a quantum system. Quantum can break traditional encryption. All right, and if we're going to build quantum, we also build what I would call encryption-safe quantum encryption, meaning it could not be broken. So we looked at the downside, and we worked to counteract it, right? So we built encryption that could not be broke by quantum systems. So the idea that, because you've got this thing about the purpose is to augment and help man, not destroy it. Second one, I think you got to get clear on who owns the data. And then the third thing is you got to do things that explain technology and build trust in it. So that could get to bias. And these sound like high-level things, but then go test what you do on them. Like, can you really say if you're a company and you're using AI, there's no bias? Really? You better test it if you say it. So companies can do stuff. Then I think for government, I'm a strong advocate of what we have termed precision regulation. Because I do have a great fear for all of what you described, all of the different points of view, or people not really understanding what they're regulating, could completely derail the digital economy. On the other hand, I'd rather deal with the bad actors, and that's what I mean by precision. And precision to me has kind of got three big pieces. For a consumer, and I'm not a consumer company, but for consumers, you should have to give consent, you could opt out, you could get yourself deleted. I mean, if I'm being very basic about what I should be able to do. I think the second thing is liability protection, meaning you should be able to hold me accountable if I do something illegal or for hate. Now, that is judgmental, I agree on this topic. But I was quite involved with Senator Portman, who had legislation on, it was called SESTA-FOSTA, which is about child sex trafficking. And he was dealing with some other companies trying to pass legislation that said, if you knowingly hosted child sex trafficking, you would be held accountable. And others would not agree to that. They said, no, I'm just a dumb pipe. And he had called myself and a few others and said, "What if I asked you this, what would you say?" Honestly, it's one of the few times it took me maybe 2 seconds. I'm like, yes, of course I should be liable. If I knowingly am doing it, I'm used to living in a world of anti-money laundering. If I know it, I have to turn it in. Of course, if I know it. And so this idea of why, to me, these are things we shouldn't be fighting about. These are very values-based and should have been agreed to. But anyways, consumer consent, liability protections, and I think the third thing for precision is got to do around explaining technologies, like for companies, so that you can trust these technologies. That is the other ditch on the side of the road. People aren't going to trust them if they don't understand how they make decisions and what they do. So I would do regulations around those three, and that's, we got real involved, and I did too, in AI ethics principles for lots of governments. So to kind of keep them in the center and not go too far away so that you derail the digital economy. That's what I would do.
And speaking of derailing the digital economy, you know,
we're going to hang up
to data protection and stewardship. You know, obviously we're moving toward a world where, you know, we're more and more electric vehicles, where your updates are downloaded just like a new app, to your phone, and increasingly the Internet of Things. And yet, you know, we have been hammered over the head over just the last couple weeks with the Colonial Pipeline hack and now the JGB meatpacking, JBS, sorry, meatpacking hack. You know, talk about an ability to derail an economy. And its attribution is tough. It's asymmetric. The richer, more technologically endowed countries are more vulnerable. How concerned are you?
Well, I'm extremely concerned. And I mean, I don't think it's a matter of whether you're hacked, it's just when. And then how fast you can return, right? So it's almost, you know, I have like a couple little visions in my mind of what I, little analogies on this topic, if I'm a company. One is that I would always assume the bad guy's in there somewhere. And so when I think of my own cyber protection, I would use AI a lot because I'm looking for, I used to use these words, footprints in the sand. Like, just what would be those little indicators ahead of time that, because they're in there, like your body has germs in it, they're in there already. So one is my approach to security would have a lot to do with AI. The second thing you should be, is, okay, knowing it's going to happen, how fast can you come back up? So I'd spend my time on resilience, really. And how to, I use this kind of a medical analogy, and I think it's still good, I've used it for a long time, like, okay, if your arm has a disease, you kind of want to stop it here, right? Better chop it off there than let it go through your whole, chop it off, sorry, that's kind of morbid, but then let it go through the whole thing here, right? And so I think that's a second point, is that you would really spend your time on how to be sure that there is no one single thing that takes down, you know, and you talk about that, I'm not familiar personally. I haven't worked on the JBS issue, but you'll notice they talked about certain parts of the world being down, not the whole world being down. So obviously they've done some work, they call that, to be sure that this was a very flat network, that they were not able to spread like a tree everywhere. So I think it's very real. I'd apply AI to all of my work I did. I would focus all my time on resilience, knowing something is going to happen. And you know, this is basics on things like, you know where your crown jewels are, don't put them all in one place, separate them. I mean, there's many things I think at a high level, you'd be surprised how many firms still don't do.
So I want to end sort of where we began with a question on leadership. You know, because you have the benefit of having been there for many years, and yet now you also have the benefit of being able to look from the side a little bit because you're not in the CEO role anymore. But what do you think in terms of, I mean, it seems to me the CEO position is becoming very, very fraught politically because of all of the things that are going on. Because of the, if you're a multinational corporation, all of the different markets that you're operating in and where you have, let's go back to that word again, stakeholders. And, you know, also with 24-hour markets, 24-hour traditional and social media, the reaction function, the scorecard, if you will, is going to be instantaneous. And, you know, it just seems to me that as we look at companies, you know, CEOs coming out very strongly on, say, voting rights issues in places like Georgia or Texas or what have you. But then being asked, well, how do you feel about those similar rights of representation in a place like China, in Xinjiang, where you've got supply chain or you're trying to sell in the commercial markets of China? It seems like the ethics, the political knots that can be, you can get tied up in are becoming quite fraught. But there's also, you know, CEOs are leaders. And as you said, most trusted institutions in America now. What's the right balance here?
Yeah, look, I think what we have witnessed, right, is also a bit of a product of, with a very divided political system, if no one's in the middle, sometimes companies are being looked at to play that role in the middle and therefore thrust into having a view on things. But I always go back again, as you said, you've been, I think you said it politely, you're old is what you said a second ago, is what you're saying, director. You just said that the subcaption on the little screen was that. And so, you know, what I learned of anything through my years, because I had a really big workforce of over half a billion, right? And to say, to get clear about the topics that matter to us and to say to the workforce, these are the things we will speak out on and these, and because for these reasons. And, you know, I want to say, I even remember writing a letter on this early on to say, if it had to do with things that would affect people's trust in us, because it's like the number one reason why we run all the mission critical systems of the world, trust. If it has to do with preparing society, hence why we got so involved in education, to benefit right. from technology and not hate it. And if it had to do with diversity and inclusion, meaning to have everybody at work feel like they can bring themselves to work, right? That they're full self to work. And of course, we'd always have the environment. So those would be the things we would speak out about. It doesn't mean the others aren't important. We may not be the one to speak out on them. And by the way, it was also a reason why, how could you participate in countries that you did not necessarily agree with everything that they said? And or did, right? Like, you know, we're in 170 countries. But I always, and I felt strongly, and it's as an example, when President Trump had formed his advisory board, I was on that. And, you know, like any company, I had 50% of people thought it was a good idea, 50% didn't like it. And I felt every IBM CEO had advised every president of every major country in history, and that your ability, you've heard many people say this, to have influence, right, is you have to engage. It is about engagement. And it'll always be about policy, not politics. And I think that's a really good rule of thumb, that if what you're intervening on is policy versus politics, sometimes hard to discern, but in many cases it would be policy. So, like, I played a really active role in those bathroom bills that were in two major states where we had big workforce populations who people felt very strongly they didn't feel safe at work if that were to happen. And so we took really strong stands with those governors about, you know, what it would mean to us as a company if those, that legislation, I would never pass, you know, in those places. It would probably rear its head again. But I think in today's world, because you are asked on everything, it's even more the reason to spend time and articulating it, particularly starting with employees. It may end up being to shareholders and more, but it particularly to your employees about, you know, why these are the topics that matter to you, and therefore these are the ones you'll engage with and speak out on, and that it doesn't mean others aren't important. Just trust me, there's a million other really important topics, but you may not, right? We spoke out on dreamers as an example. We have many employees in that category. So that would be my best sort of, in retrospect, learning that I would share on that.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachiwara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.